Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this European Institute public lecture at the LSE with Romano Prodi, the President of the European Commission. As you can see, there was an enormous amount of interest in this lecture. We have almost 1,000 people here, and as I look around, it just occurs to me to wonder, I wonder if we said on the publicity that this was going to be in Italian. Well, you'll have to see how you go. I think that Romano Prodi needs little introduction from me. When a chairman says that, that usually means that he is going to read out the CV from primary school onwards. But on this occasion, I genuinely will not do that. You are all very much aware that Signor Prodi is President of the European Commission, has been for 4.5 years, and will be until the end of October this year. And over lunch, Signor Prodi asked me to say that on the 1st of November he will be unemployed and very interested in any offers which people here may have. Of course, before that, he was Prime Minister of Italy, but it's right that I do tell you for a moment of his connections with the LSE, because Signor Prodi's earlier career was as an industrial economist. He was here first in 1963 as a research student, working under Professor Basil Yami, whom I'm pleased to say is here with us today, and has retained a strong connection with the school ever since. He became an honorary fellow in 1989 and then did what many people do, which is send us a son here who also did a degree later on in the 90s. So his connection with the LSE has been very strong. He has lectured here before, but we are absolutely delighted that he has chosen to come to the school to talk about the Constitution for Europe. This, of course, is a somewhat fraught topic at present after the rather curious non-outcome of the summit last December. But Signor Prodi is going to explain it all to us this afternoon, why it's necessary, what's going to happen next, and he's also agreed, after doing all this, that he will take our questions. So I hope that you will begin by welcoming him to the school. We are very much looking forward to what you have to say. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the introduction, because you underlined what is more important for me today. Let's say that I feel really at home in the London School of Economics, even if when you presented me, I remember that it was 40 years ago that I was student here. You know, 40 years are such a big number of years that, well, let us go on. But I find really interesting that the debate about the European Union here so often starts by asking whether this union is essentially a political or an economic enterprise. There seems to be agreement that the European Union based on economic and trades make sense. But the implication that the European Union is on economic is that they should steer clear of anything that is political. Here on the platform at the London School of Economics and Political Science, however, it seems that it might not be so easy to draw clear distinction between political aspect and economic aspect of the Union. It is clear that the Europe of the single market and the single currency has now assumed a stronger political dimension as a broad area of shared principle and values. And it will assume a more and more political dimension. And honestly, I tell you that I consider this a remarkable result of my mandate to bring the Commission more and more to be a political body. And this is tested also by the work that we have done for performing the enlargement. As you know, in May this year, 10 new member states will join the Union. And this means 75 million new consumers. Yet, the economic opportunities available in an expanded single market are the subject of business seminars up and down United Kingdom and other member states. But enlargement is much, much more than economics. Enlargement takes place because the governments and people of the new member states see their destinies as part of the European Union family, even if some contradiction and some fears that can be totally eliminated only through a period of common life. The enlargement represents the major political process in the European history. And it is based on the will expressed clearly by million people through referendum or through parliaments. In 8 of the new member states, the decision to join has been backed by a referendum with impressive majorities in favor. It is perhaps a paradox that although the European Union may have become less popular in some of the current member states, there have never been such a wave of positive political support and desire to join from so many aspiring members. But if you look deeply into it, is this really a paradox? In my experience as the President of the Commission, I have realized that Europe is often considered far more of a reality and an ambitious and necessary political project when this project is viewed from outside. When I went to the European Union-China or European Union-India summit in autumn last year, I could really sense the great interest and the high expectation that the European Union has stimulated in the emerging powers like China or India. And when you look at Europe in a global context, it is far less easy to doubt our need for it. You can test this from the interest that China has shown for the euro. It is remarkable how in the different summits that we have each year with China, the problem of the euro not only as an economic or financial instrument, but as a strong political instrument is put on the table. In the meeting of, not of this, of 2003, but in the meeting of 2002, the last one of the previous Chinese presidency, it was clear and openly stated that the euro were appreciated by the Chinese government, not only in its financial aspect, but also because it was a help to overcome a monopolar world. I use the expression of the Chinese authority. The euro is the symbol of a pluripolar world, and this is welcomed by China. So all the people who were telling that the euro decision was only a financial decision, and Europe was only the Europe of bankers, they can understand how wrong is this opinion. But now the world is becoming increasingly interdependent, economies have become transnational, and the major political issues are all global. And the new situation requires a response that cannot be met within national frameworks in Europe. Of course, and this must be clear, especially in the United Kingdom, that nation states are here to stay, but they need to cooperate more and manage better their relations in a wider European framework if they are to defend and pursue interests that are increasingly shared. If European nation states want to be stronger, they must act together. There is no alternative. This feeling and the desire to join a large area of prosperity and stability are the roots of the success of the referendums in the new member states. And the European Union and the member states now have a clear political obligation to make the prosperity and stability of the European Union framework a fact of life also for those living in the new member states. And this will be done and can be done. The previous enlargements are the demonstration of how you can manage with a core of countries with a higher level of income and higher productivity with a new number of countries with lower level of income and lower productivity, and bring the new country to grow more than the average and give a contribution also to the old countries. I think that the enlargement is the most important mission of my commission. But now, looking forward, one of my biggest concerns for the future is to maintain and to increase prosperity in the Union. And for this purpose, in spring 2000, the European Union head of state and government set out an ambitious agenda, nothing less than to make the European Union the most dynamic place to do business on the planet by the end of this decade. The Lisbon process has brought liberalization to new areas of the European Union economy, energy, telecommunication, intellectual property law, and many others. Lisbon also was about benchmarking European Union government learning from one another, learning the experience of other countries. And the economic dream for any European country would surely be to achieve both Britain's high level of employment and the best continental productivity levels. The process of this peer review is still continuing. The third aspect of Lisbon was improving the mechanism for developing effective common European Union legislation, so often dismissed as red tape in many quarters, but absolutely necessary for a working single market and for the productivity growth. To give one example of the benefit of the Lisbon process, I would like to turn to the financial service sector, the forgotten frontier of Europe's single market. Here in London, the financial service capital of the European Union, it is perhaps easier to see the potential benefit for the city of expanding markets for their service. The Financial Service Action Plan, which my commission has driven forward since Lisbon, is our vision for removing regulatory and other public policy barriers. But of course, greater integration of financial market has broader benefits for the economy as a whole. A consolidated, deep and liquid capital market creates enormous potential to the entire continent. and we have already started to witness the appearance of new markets and new financial technique. Venture capital, private equity markets are increasingly important sources of capital, not just for established business, but for all important small starts up, which are so vital when it comes to creating the jobs of the future. And for individual households, the integration of financial market bring with it the prospect of lower mortgage and borrowing cost. But it is also necessary to accompany the formation of a new financial market with a common set of regulations necessary to prevent fraud and mismanagement. The recent examples of financial scandals demonstrate that we cannot have a different dimension between the markets and the regulatory authorities. The enlargement of the financial market has gone hand in hand with the introduction of the single currency in 12 European Union member states. It is clear that we hope that UK will eventually join economic and monetary union, but it's not for us or for me to say or suggest if and when the UK should be member of the euro. In any case, benefits are already being felt in the United Kingdom by firms trading with the eurozone, holiday makers traveling there, and the growing number of Britons living there. These benefits range from lower exchange and transfer cost to the deeper and more liquid capital markets I have mentioned before. I know that the UK government keeps its assessment on whether to pursue the membership of the euro under review, weighing the cost and benefits of joining. Meanwhile, the euro has already become a great protagonist of the world economy and of the world financial markets. But despite all that has been achieved through the euro and the Lisbon Agenda, Europe still needs to improve its economic situation. The productivity gap between the European Union and the US is widening. Labor productivity is growing four times faster in the United States than in Europe. And this is not surprising, not only for the urgent need of important reforms in some European countries, but also because the benefits of enlarged market are always slow to materialize. This was for the US market in the beginning. However, after two difficult years, the European Union economy is finally showing timid signs of recovery. And this recovery is encouraging, and we must make all the effort to speed it up. This is why last October we launched the European Growth Initiative with the European Investment Bank. The simple aim was to speed up the implementation of the Lisbon Strategy. The initiative mobilized public and private funds to finance key infrastructure and research projects of truly European dimension that can have an impact through the Union. Overall, the Growth Initiative established a stable long-term framework for priority infrastructure and research projects until 2020. And while it means the means are relatively modest by comparison with the budget of the member state government, the end result has the potential to attract multiple capital and to inspire other projects. With resources of around 5 billion euros annually, this spending is fully compatible with the Stability and Growth Pact. It is also well within the ceilings which we believe will be necessary for the future financing of the European Union. On future financing, I want to underline again that the European Union budget is extremely modest by comparison with public expenditure by member state, most of which spend between 40 and 50% of their initial GDP. The current ceiling of 1.24% of GDP that we never reached as a consequence of an increasing severe control of the budget correspond to the social security budget of one large member state. And when I ask to non, let's say, non-professional students, which is the budget of the European Union, the answer is never less than 5%, because there is this idea that the European budget is so big, while extremely modest. This year, I repeat, I spent 0.99% of the European GDP to do all agricultural policy, structural policy, justice, home affairs, research, everything included. You know. We are now on the eve of the biggest enlargement in the European Union history, which many people see as uniting for the first time in history the European continent. Somebody speaks about reunification of Europe. It's not true. Europe has never been united. This is the unification of Europe. And this is an odd moment to propose lowering the ceiling of the European Union resources to 1%, as some member states have suggested. For the years from 2007, is important that the European Union institutions are given the resources to achieve the goals that the European Union leaders themselves have set in the European Council. If we want to get the goals, we need the minimal proper resources. Thanks to the improvement in efficiency the Commission has made over the past 4 years, I don't need to argue for an increase in resources. And I have, therefore, a duty to the future of the organization to defend it against any cuts in resources in real terms. I could never approve a contradiction between our tasks and the necessary resources. And I repeat, the task has been given us by the member states, some of them who want now to cut resources. I am talking about major tasks that are urgently needed and that will greatly benefit the citizens of Europe and which were unanimously approved by all 15 member states. If we are asked to increase our prosperity, we are asked to strengthen the competitiveness of our firms, we are asked to meet the demands of our citizens for more security, freedom, justice. If it's so, we must satisfy their concern about the environment, public health, and food safety. To face these challenges in the years to come, Europe will have to pursue and strengthen the Lisbon strategy, focusing on key issues such as improving the quality of education, training and training in the Union, and increasing European research and technological development. Human capital is a major factor that determines growth, and we must do much more to modernize and make our education, training, and research system more competitive. Research and economic development are strongly interlinked as factors for economic growth, and we have to redouble our effort in this area. The challenge is that the European Union head of state and government have set themselves the goal of an increased European investment in research and development to 3% of GDP in 2010, of which 2/3 should come from private sector. And this is, if we want to win the challenge, the world challenge and the new globalization, we need to increase our R&D investments. And in the future of Europe, human resources will have the highest priority. Also for the experience with the past, if we take the new member states of the previous enlargements, which is a state who behaved better than any other states in terms of development, Ireland. If you analyze where Ireland has spent the European funds, mainly in human resources, education, research, and trading. And this is a clear teaching for the future. If we want to survive against the old and new competition, we must invest more in research and development. If we want to have an effective role, there are some fields in this domain that cannot be done individually by member states. If we need some huge advanced laboratory for the advanced research and development, the member states are too small to challenge the US research and development structure. So I don't know if we can found the European Science Foundation or something similar, but we have to think that if we don't do that, we will lose our challenge. And Europe will also have to build an effective area of security, freedom, justice. Think of increased frequency of cross-border transactions, the need to ensure better protection for European Union interests and values against criminal activities. Think to the challenge of immigration and asylum, which all require a common European response. Finally, Europe must fill the gap between its economic weight and its political role on the world scene. It must assume the responsibility of a regional leader, creating new special relationships with all its neighbors in the East and in the Mediterranean. And I want to use a ring of friends surrounding the Union and its closest European neighbors from Morocco to Russia. This is the objective of our new neighborhood policy. And Europe must assume the responsibility of a global actor, developing a new strategic approach to international challenge, because the new Union is neither a purely civil power nor a pure military power. It will have to develop civil protection and defense policy, focusing on preemptive engagement and multilateralism to face fundamental threats such as terrorism, proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, and organized crime. This is why the last European Council in December 2003 was correctly perceived as a serious negative event. It is clear that at that European Council we missed a great opportunity. We missed a great and necessary opportunity because Europe needs some fundamental institutional change. Europe must understand the new political challenge that have confronted it since the beginning of the present millennium. It must renew its process and procedure in order to meet the challenge it faces. Europe needs a constitution if we want to bring the process closer to the people. This objective, identified by all our heads of state and government 3 years ago at the Laeken Summit, when they decided to set up a European Convention, are even more compelling today. I welcome the process that has been made in the European Convention in 1 year and a half of transparent and democratic work. The Convention is the most ambitious and democratic institutional project in our history. And thanks to the contribution of delegates from the national parliament and government, representatives of the European Parliament and of the Commission, it did a very good job. The fact that the European Union government have on the table a single text with relatively few open questions exceeds the expectation many had in the aftermath of the Nice European Council 3 years ago when I proposed radically changing the way of negotiating European treaties, and I called for the creation of this new, more democratic and legitimate body that is the Convention. The draft text is the result of an open debate, not just among European Union institutions, but between governments and, for the first time, all the national parliaments of the member state and of the new member states. This was the first time that the goals and purpose of the European Union have been discussed so openly and by representatives from so many walks of life. In terms of substance, the discussion made enormous progress, simplifying the way European Union works and introducing political innovation for the future. It is my view that finalizing this intergovernmental conference is one of the biggest political priorities for the European Union this year. That is absolutely possible. The Convention, in fact, has produced a very good basis. Therefore, I am sorry that in Brussels there was no agreement, and as a matter of fact, not even a general open debate. I repeat that, as many have made it clear, there were no discussions about the most important matters at the European Union Council in Brussels. And so we have to start again from the Convention. But the failure of the Brussels meeting has increased the level of preoccupation and the commitments of all the European heads of state and government. They know, and openly admit now, that an agreement is needed and the text of the Convention can be a strong, positive compromise. Even more, they recognize the heavy negative consequence for the life of the Union in case of lack of agreement in the year 2004. It is clearly up to European government to take the final decision, but I am confident that the passionate, professional, and discreet work of the Irish presidency can reach the agreement during the semester, or can prepare a draft that can be completed by the following Dutch presidency. The European Union machine needs to be equipped to respond to the aspiration of its current and new members. That response needs to be one of vision and leadership, not of recrimination. Moreover, agreement on the text will give to the citizen giving clear answer to some key issues. From a UK perspective, for example, looking at how the European debate has developed in the last years, the new text clarifies once and for all that the European Union is not a super state. Is neither the end of 1,000 years of independent Britain, not a blueprint for tyranny, as some of the UK press would have you believe. It clearly delineates the relationship between the member states and the European Union framework. It extends the European Parliament's co-decision powers to new areas and will, for the first time, give a formal role to national parliament in shaping European Union decision. The myth that a proposal by me today will become law in the United Kingdom tomorrow without any democratic control or discussion is one of the most pernicious misrepresentations of the reality. Dear students, we have to move ahead with the institutional reforms, and we must do this year. Politically, Europe needs a new constitution. Without one, it will be much more difficult for the European Union to deliver the goals of prosperity and stability which the European leaders have set. Clearly, there are risks involved in any solution, and the Commission is determined that we should all move forward together, sharing the same rights and the same responsibility. But, as I said last week before the European Parliament, its efforts in this direction were to become bogged down, it would clearly be impossible to remain passive, simply looking at the complete paralysis of European institutions. As it happened so many times in 50 years of European history, a group of member states, in this case, will decide to enhance their level of integration. Europe is already an area of peace, prosperity, and stability. And this increasing effort to address the concern of its citizens and accomplish practical concrete projects and achievement. Europe is also an example to the world of an area of sustainable development, guaranteeing practical benefits well beyond just the single market. And Europe is the best answer to the new challenge of globalization, bringing added value where it is most needed, while respecting the diversity and tradition of each of its members. These are major successes of which we must be proud and which make Europe a unique model in the world. But this is not enough to face the new challenge ahead of us. We need a new constitution that will give the Union the necessary means and instrument to pursue its policy in a new globalized world. Only if we are united can we preserve and increase our autonomy and our influence. Only if we are united can we successfully meet the new historical challenge. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, President Preddy, for that very wide-ranging address on all sorts of aspects of European development, indeed in describing this as primarily about the Constitution. We have undersold your speech today. Now, you have kindly agreed to take some questions, and I'll now invite questions from the audience, and there are stewards with microphones, and I see a man with a pen in the central, about halfway up the first aisle. If it's possible, could you say name and where you're from, which I'm sure will help the President answer.
Bill Hayton, BBC World Service. Towards the end, you said a group of member states, I think, could push ahead with enhanced integration, which is another way of saying two-speed Europe. What do you mean by that? I mean, if some people, if there's no convention text agreed, and some states do push ahead with enhanced integration, does that mean some states stay with Nice and others push on with greater degrees of qualified majority voting in new areas? How would you see that going forward?
Well, it's very simple. I told clearly we must make any effort for all this year to have an agreement among all 25 member states. This is our effort. And the Irish presidency is working strongly in this direction. Of course, what I told and I repeat, if there is not this decision, Europe cannot go on with the speed of the slowest wagon. And so, as it happened with the euro, you know, it's not a strange fact. You know, I hope you know that not all the European Union member states are members of the euro, you know, and this is a typical case in which you had some member who decided to go beyond and to do something more than others. My only preoccupation in this case is that the cooperation must be open to all member states. We cannot conceive an exclusive group of European member states who exclude the others. This is not Europe, but to have somebody who take more initiative and more speed is a constant tradition of our European history.
You can be sure, Mr. President, that the BBC will not sex up that response in their report.
You never know.
My name is Mark Glendunning from the Democracy Movement. I have two very brief questions for you. You talked about democracy, yet the new constitution under Article 25 will continue to give the unelected commission the virtual monopoly right to introduce new legislation. Now, this is not what we were promised by the Larkin Declaration, and many people, including the Union of European Federalists and other organizations, are very critical of your constitution because it patently fails, or Giscard's constitution, rather, it patently fails to fundamentally democratize the Union. Secondly, you will have seen that your friend Mr. Berlusconi was recently had his immunity from criminal prosecution removed, quite rightly, I think, in the opinion of the vast majority of Europeans. I'd be interested to know what your view is on this, and would you like to see the criminal immunities that various members of the European Union, including members of the Commission and the European Parliament, enjoy? Would you like to see these immunities
removed
exempted, as well?
Exempted to answer the second question?
No, I think you should answer it.
No.
He has immunity from those questions. So.
To the first question, yes, look. I don't understand which is the concept of democracy, but, you know, I have been appointed by the 15 states of heads of state and government who are all of them democratic leaders. I've been approved four times, two times from the old parliament and two times for the new parliament. Every month I go at least twice in front of the parliament to expose my position, and they vote on that, and they decide on that. Well, democracy is not only direct democracy. Democracy is a process in which you have also a second step democracy. And when you are appointed by democratic bodies and you are responsible in front of the parliamentary debate, you are a democratic body. I'm sorry, but this is democracy. And you have direct democracy if you run directly for the election, but you can also have, you know, be appointed by in the second stage. This is democracy. You know, personally, I think that some days we may arrive to a direct election of the Commission. I approve it, but you need more interaction of European countries, you know. Because if now you have, let's say, for example, for the new president of the Commission, if you have a contest, you know, between an Italian or a German and British, you know, it's difficult to have a discussion together, media together, platform together, to have a real campaign in first stage. You have to understand that. This is why in this phase we have this second type democracy that we call indirect democracy, but it is democracy.
Thank you. Now, I'm just warning people, I have a lot of people attracting my attention, and I will try to be as fair as I can to different parts of the hall. I have a question down here, and then we'll have one from the cheaper seats after that. There.
Milana Borden, Ashbourne Beaver Associates. Mr. Prodi, you spoke a lot about enlargement being priority of your presidency, but we all know that Europe was divided over the war in Iraq. Do you foresee a united Europe after the enlargement on the 1st of May, or do you think it will continue to be divided? Thank you.
Well, in your question, you already were very clear that the division was not because of the enlargement, you know, because this is a concept that we have to keep clear. Somebody said to me, why you make the enlargement that Europe is divided? But Europe is not divided because of the enlargement. Europe is divided because it's divided, you know. But, no, because the old members are divided, you know. But, you know, I tell you one observation very clear about Iraq. It's strange, you know. In the scientific text concerning Europe, you know, you always read about demos, the lack of some sort of European spirit. And in the war of Iraq, we had the government split, but the European demos was all united in great percentage against the war. And it's quite strange. But it's quite strange, almost, well, inexplicable, that you had almost the same percentage, the same statistical behavior, you know, in countries like UK, that the government went to the war, or Spain, or Italy, and countries like France or Germany that were strongly against. Public opinion was united. And sometimes this will speak to the heart of all Europeans, you know, because when you have this type of feeling independent from the government, is because the demos, the spirit exists.
Thank you. One.
Yeah, Julius Eckhardt, student at the European Institute. Considering that at the beginning of your speech you mentioned the EU seen by, for example, China as a shining example of peace and prosperity, considering the growing unwillingness of the current EU member states to give more money, and considering the growing enlargement and even more countries wanting to join in the near future, how much longer do you think the EU can stay this shining example of peace and prosperity?
Oh, I am really convinced that the enlargement will help to increase the rate of growth of the Union. I am convinced, as it happened, I repeat before, with Spain, Ireland, Portugal, you know, when they came in, they have not had a negative effect on the rate of growth. They had a positive effect on the rate of growth. And so I am firmly convinced that the enlargement will help prosperity. We have to run it with intelligence. Because we have in the same, you are, most of you are students of economics, we have in the same economic area countries with high level of productivity and high cost of labor or cost, and low level of productivity and low cost. So you have to make a very flexible, intelligent policy. But it's the typical case in which you will increase your rate of growth and not decrease it. This is our challenge. But I take the occasion also to tell you, you know, there is always the question, you know, you're a large Europe, but how large? You know, what is Europe? Which are the borders of Europe? Because this is one of the most important points that we have to put in our mind now, you know. And I tell you, 15 member countries, 10 new countries in May, so 450 million people. Then Bulgaria, Romania, that are already negotiating. Turkey, candidate country, still not negotiating. The decision will be taken next fall. And then, in my opinion, the Balkans. This is Europe. This is Europe. Then, this is why I stressed in my speech the so-called Ring of Friends. Because all the neighbor countries from Russia to Morocco will be offered to share with Europe everything but institutions. Let's say not be member of the Parliament or the Commission, but to have common, in due time, you know, custom union, technical regulations, scientific policy, sharing of scientific policy, all, everything but institutions. So this is a definite shape of Europe that we have in mind for the, you know, for the foreseeable future.
Is that microphone working or not? It does work. Last time, sir, you asked a very long question. This time, it's going to be a short one. Good.
Thank you. Thank
you. You have a good memory.
President Romeo, thank you. Yep. See, rather than building a bridge to Turkey, so the EU is digging a ditch around Turkey. That's what the American media portrays you. So what?
Sorry.
Turkey membership of Turkey to your European Union. So you are not building a bridge, but you are digging a dug around the European Union. That is what is American media portrays. What do you think? You maybe in future, maybe if Tony Blair replaces you, will the EU be kind enough to accommodate Turkey? And you kindly mentioned about India and China. What do you think that EU could do for the Indo-Pakistan, the new peace which is coming? Not. Thank you. Am I short?
Thank you. Well done. So there were two questions, really, I think. One was, is the EU really building a bridge to Turkey or, in fact, digging a ditch around Turkey? And secondly, can the EU in its outreach do anything on the
Indian Pakistan? For Turkey, I'm just left. I just came back from Turkey the day before yesterday, 2 days of deep conversation. We are really making a bridge seriously, professionally. And, on Turkey, the Americans are nice guys, because they say, I tell you a long conversation that I had with President Clinton when I was Prime Minister of Italy. He told, look, you have to take Turkey in the Union as we did with Mexico. I said, look, but, I told him, tell me the name of the Mexican senator in the capital. And President Clinton, who is it, he would say, no, I understand now, but I push you. And it was very, we went deep into the conversation. But the first attitude of the American public opinion is, is like a custom union. Please, European Union is not a custom union, even if somebody wants to do it, So the Commission is working on the Turkey dossier. We have one job only to do, to analyze whether Turkey is complying the so-called Copenhagen criteria. Let's say human rights, democracy, separation of military service, justice, autonomy of justice, all these clear Copenhagen criteria. We have to do that. If these criteria are met, the negotiation will start. So it's not only a bridge, it's a serious bridge, And the conflict between India and Pakistan, the limit of the European Union in foreign policy. I never have undervalued and underestimated them. So our influence can be more of persuasion than anything more. This is what we are doing. This is what I have done, meeting the Indian authorities and the Pakistani authority. I know that is limited power for now. And this is why I think we need a common foreign policy.
Thank you. Right, next one is a woman in white over there, which I advise you in future is quite a good tactic because you're more visible that way, right? You, and then I'll go to the front row up here.
Professore, you mentioned earlier, or Professor Davies mentioned, your future unemployment possibilities. And I was going to ask you if you are considering any re-employment in Italian politics, as we would all welcome that.
No, look, you know that in European welfare state, the unemployment benefits are so high.
Calculate that they would just about last you until the next election, because they're usually very generous for 1 year, I think. Question front row here.
Signor Prodi.
Can we go back to names, etc.?
Yes, my name's John Mirza, law student. I agree with you that there have been referenda in these new accession countries that have been in favour of joining the European Union. However, they've also been referenda in countries which are already members of the European Union, such as in Denmark, in Ireland, and most recently in Sweden, which have voted against various European policies. Now, under your provision for a constitution for Europe, you say that you will bring Europe closer to the people, which I do think is a big problem at the moment. So will you support Valéry Giscard's proposal that all the peoples of Europe will have a referendum on this constitution?
I always approve of this proposal strongly, but it's difficult to get. You know, there is no agreement on that. But clearly, a referendum at European level would be a complete change. But the member states don't agree on that. You know, because all of them say we need a referendum in my country, and I count my votes. But it's clear in the end, as you link it to the question you posed, you know, you must arrive someday to have this idea of Uruguay democracy as seen as a united body. But I repeat, we are very far from that. And now we have to consolidate the institution for a stronger cooperation and be realistic on what we can get and what we cannot get. Your idea, Giscard idea, is a fantastic idea. Will be for our, my sons, no, it's too early. let's say the second generation. Yeah, because, you know, we needed more than 40 years to have the euro. When you have to reform things through democracy, you are slow. You are slow. Because, you know, everybody must share the view. And so I'm not ashamed to tell you that we shall need a lot of time, but we have to go in this direction.
Thank you. Next one, I had a woman right at the back row in the stalls. Yes, you have your hand up. Thank you.
You have a formidable eyes, you know.
Thank you. My name is Nidhi Trehan. I'm a PhD student in sociology. I wanted to ask Romano Prodi about what I consider to be a very serious problem within Europe and within member states already, and then the newly acceding states. And this is the integration of the Romani, or gypsy population, which will be the largest minority within Europe's boundaries. As we know, I mean, I don't have to go over the history, but they were victims of the Holocaust. They have been in Europe for over 1,000 years. They have made immense cultural contributions. And my question to you is, I know that Europe has begun a kind of debate. In the 70s, there was educational policies aimed at Roma. But considering that the newly acceding countries will have a huge number of Roma, I'm talking Slovakia, Czech Republic, Hungary, et cetera, then Romania, which has the largest, and Bulgaria. Do you have any plan or any vision for the integration of Roma in Europe? Obviously, I think exceptional measures need to be taken because their situation is quite different from immigrant populations in Europe. Yeah. Thank you.
You're completely right. And probably, madam, is one of the most difficult problems that we have, you know, because there are many and the integration is difficult. But we put the Roma chapter in any negotiation chapter, in any negotiation with the new member states. This was deliberately put as necessity of protecting all the minority and treating them in equal terms. And Roma were mentioned. Then we have also some European level experiment on how to integrate Romas. And I tell you that also personally, this is probably that I've taken seriously. I understand that now the financial means in the direction are not sufficient. And thank you for having even once more reminded me this problem, because if we don't solve it, we shall have terrible problems in the future.
Thank you. A question from a man with a moustache. The rules in the school require us to have one question from someone with facial hair every 20. Yeah.
My name's Paolo Falco, and I'm an economics student. I've been lately reading about your appeal, Professor Prodi, to the Italian parties to form a lista unica, a united coalition. Does that mean that your interest has actually shifted towards a re-employment in Europe, in Italy, as Anna was questioning you about before?
No, it's not linked to that. You know, the idea of one so-called lista unica it is a part of the so-called intellectual side of my mind, you know, because don't forget that I've been professor for 25 years, you know, in my life. You know, I went to politics very late, you know, and I tell you that I had a strange adventure in my life, that I delivered my first speech to the plenary of the Italian Parliament as Prime Minister, because I entered, made the campaign, I won, and, you know, so I entered in politics in this way. So I think that I have all the legitimate right to think and to use my mind, but I can do it from Brussels, and I don't need to go to Italy to do that.
Thank you. A woman at the back, yes.
Yes, my name is Camilla Toulmin from the International Institute for Environment and Development. There's some disquiet amongst development organizations such as ours about the perceived dilution of the European Union's interest and commitment to economic development in poorer parts of the world, and the subordination of development policy to foreign and security concerns. There's also some worry that the 10 new member states acceding in May have very little historical engagement or interest with the developing world. We feel that the EU has a particularly important geopolitical role in today's context in articulating a distinct voice and pathway to a fairer world. How can you reassure us of the priority that the EU in its new constitution will accord to these issues?
Well, I cannot reassure you in the sense that this development aid chapter, it is a shame, not only for Europe, no, less for Europe than from others, you know, but we decreased historically in the last generation our commitment. We started to re-engage this in Monterrey, but we are still less than half of the minimum 0.7% that we engaged, officially engaged in our summits, you know. What I tell you that I take this as a priority, I fight for that, and that in the priorities I also put Africa as priorities of the priorities, in the sense that I think that Africa is a European responsibility. European responsibility. And we must take Africa on our shoulders. This is clear. And the cost will be much less than the cost of the wars that will accompany this, you know. We have to do in many directions. For example, in the last European Union meeting in Maputo, I also told to the African leader that we are disposed to put money for an African peacekeeping, African Union peacekeeping corps, because I think that we must help Africa, but the policy must be done by Africans. You know, this is my attitude, but I tell you that in this historical situation, the problem of resources for third world aid is unresolved, and I am not optimist for the short run. Simply, I shall engage on it, but the answers of the government are mainly of non-further commitment in this direction.
Front row in the balcony, thanks.
I'm Thomas Montague, European Institute. Mr. Prodi, do you still think that the Stability Pact is a stupid thing? And do you think the actions taken by Germany and France are a good example for the future?
When I made the famous declaration, I didn't because of a mistake. I did after deep thinking, because there were big holes in the stability pact, because it was bad, you know. And I was unable to move to have a reaction, and so I used a strong word. After that, we did some good improvement, but it's not yet intelligent enough for dealing with the future of European economy. But in spite of that, this is the pact that we have, and we have to respect it. And so this is the reason why I put the Commission, and I was sorry to do that, against France and Germany, and why I went to the court. Because even if the pact is not satisfactory, I think that there's a basic law for democracy is to respect the rules. And the rules we have there is not perfect, but is what we call the Stability Pact.
My name is Sophia Hoffman, and I'm studying for a master's degree in international relations. I've got a question regarding security and defense policy of the European Union.
Regarding?
Security and defense. In light of the military transformations that are happening in Europe at the moment in response to the new global security environment, do you think that in the future we will see Europe acting, or Europe intervening militarily in global affairs more, or do you think that Europe will continue to develop its profile as a rather non-military actor, relying on diplomacy, European integration, dialogue, and so on?
I think that Europe must, first of all, as I told before, develop soft security, the Ring of Friends, Alliance, on. But I also think that we have to pull together someday. Of course, we'll be a slow step, but we have to put someday together our military resources. I do remember during the Kosovo War that I learned this necessity because the Americans were telling me, look, you Europeans, you are strange guys. You spend 60% at that time, now will be 50, of American budget, defense budget, and you have a defense capability that is less than 10% of our defense capability. And I don't know, because I'm not an expert, I don't know how they could say 10 or 5%, but anyway, this is clear. And so my reaction was, look, we have to have some also military coordination at a continental level, at the Union level, because otherwise money wasted, because they demonstrated that we were even unable to have joint missions to communicate among ourselves in efficient military way to do that. So I think that it's obvious that we must pull together all our resources also in this field. I repeat, it's not for today. There is now a starting, process for that. But in the future of Europe, I see also a common defense policy.
Thank you. Woman in red on the balcony, yes.
Hi, my name is Xu Lu. I come from China. I'm now the graduate student in the Industrial Relations Department. My question is very simple. So in taking the initiatives as the constitution for Europe, so are you going to unify the Europe, including also the identity, variation of the culture, of the history of every country, or you are going to take any initiative to still keep this kind of identities of the, such as the incubator of the country come from? Thank you for attention.
Thank you. Never, never, never. Europe will be always a union of people and nations. It's not only a union of people. The nation will always be there. I shall defend this, because we should never be, and you don't want to be like United States. the European nation will survive, will preserve their identity, their cultural policy. And when I talked about, to give you an example, about, let's say, cultural policy of Europe, it's clear that school, university, you know, primary school or high school, nations or regions or municipalities, universities, nations with mobility of students and professors in order to help this, but it's nation. But when you arrive to the big, let's say, advanced research, you need another dimension. But only in this case I want to put together resources. And remember, in the new member states, all member states, they all came to you with their own language. In the European Parliament, we shall use 20 different languages to preserve our culture. Even Malta, in which you know that national language is used equally with English, they came into with their own language. And I'm proud of that. I never use any language. I always use only Italian when I am in the Parliament. I never use Italian when I am in the Commission as a working language. But when there is the problem of identity, we use also our language, even if it's very complicated to have 20 languages and to manage them. But this is Europe, to preserve our identity, not to put them in some sort of boiling pan. You know, this is not Europe.
Thank you. The President's showing enormous stamina, but he's agreed that he will carry on for a little while longer. I'm always slightly suspicious of people who sit in the front row, but nonetheless, I'll...
Thank you. My name is Nicola Schober. I'm a geography student. Professor Brody, you mentioned the neighbor policy of a ring of friends around the European Union. How do you see the relationship between the European Union and Belarus, which is ruled by a dictator?
It's very simple. In the ring of friends, yes. I told before, when they were ready and when there will be a common language. Of course, Belarus now is impossible. In the future, they can be among the ring of friends. But certainly not now, because there are rules of democracy, there is necessity of cooperation, there is of that. But I do hope that someday even Belarus may have strong and friendly relation with Europe. I look forward.
Thank you.
On here, yes, man with the sort of, what color would you call that? Sort of orangey, browny, yeah.
Yes, David Dicker, I'm a student of international relations. Professor Prodi, you mentioned earlier about, I was quite interested about your analysis of Europe's security needs. Do you think a new common European defence policy could work in cooperation with NATO, or do you think it would be intrinsically a threat to NATO? Thank you.
No, only cooperate with NATO. I don't conceive any policy independent for that. You know, it's a common choice, common policy. And I do think personally, but also, as you know, I act as a council in my institution, that strong friendly relations between European Union and the United States are a necessary condition for peace.
Woman in black and white stripes.
Hi, my name is Florence Vilmano, and I'm a philosophy and economics student here. And I was wondering what kind of Europe you're aiming for. How do you see Europe in the next 50 years? What do you see it becoming?
Sorry. You are a student of Europe, but you are too quick for me.
What are your long-run aims for Europe? Like, how do you see Europe in the next 50 years?
It's an easy question. It's just, what is the European Union going to be like in 50 years' time? This is a philosopher speaking. So.
No. In 50 years, I think that we may have... let's say around, you know, completed enlargement also to the Balkan countries. And have
a remarkable set of common cooperations, a working Minister of Foreign Affairs. This is, I think this is clear. The euro, I don't know if UK will be into the euro area. This is the only question I don't know. But certainly, by far, the euro is the most important currency in the world because of the policy of France and so on. And also common defense policy. This is what I see Europe. But in 50 years, not less.
And maybe the 3 tons will have been refurbished as well. Yes, man with a microphone there in the middle.
Senior Prodi, you, Peter Lineker, former student and businessman, you spoke for the first time that I've ever heard anyone from the European Union talk about the amount of time it takes to get things done. And you mentioned that it took 40 years to get the euro in shape, but in fact the approval for that came in Maastricht in 91. So some people who are very pro-European actually get frustrated, perhaps in this country and also in other countries, where actually they feel that they aren't being properly involved in the demos that you speak about, because every time they are asked about the initiatives in Europe, they vote quite profoundly no, or only ever marginally yes. And perhaps there would be more democratic connection from the Commission if people were given more time to consider the longer sweep of the changes that are about to take place. In the UK, there is a reasonably strong sceptical element to the population, most of whom would actually say they are very pro-European. And do you think that the Constitution for Europe has missed an opportunity to genuinely engage with the people who wish to see a deeper and broader union, but one that's not thrust down their throat in what appears to be a pretty undemocratic way from the Commission?
No, you know, the proposal of the Constitution is very respectful of all these democratic principles. If you start from the Charter of Fundamental Rights, you know, there is a proposal that is open, transparent, democratic. You know, this does not mean, of course, that this will be approved immediately by all European citizens. You have to tell, you have to put in your mind that not necessarily this hesitation by population are a clear demonstration against Europe, because the changes are many times painful and difficult. And so sometimes these are a measure that say, let us take time, let us wait for that. You know, this is, I'm always insisting that we have to take the due time and to discuss and to open a debate over the continent.
Thank you. Look, you can see what an enormous amount of interest. We're going to have to finish, however, at 5:30. I'm going to take 3 more questions, and I really am going to apologize to the rest. A man with glasses, we've been discriminating against the bespectacled, first, and then there's a woman in white and purple who's been extremely patient just over there, and then someone in short sleeves here who's also been extremely patient, and I'm sorry to the rest.
My name is Salam Mathu. I'm a first-year law student here at LSE. I'm from Kashmir, India, actually.
Okay.
It's a dangerous thing to come to LSE, and you have really done very well, I think, as a speaker. My question is going to be very difficult, though. My question is regarding the relationship between United States, which you call a super state, but in my opinion, it's an empire, and the European Union. Do you think that, you know, it's at the moment, it's in the interest of the United States empire to have a very strong European Union? For they have, in a sense, divided Europe into the new and old, as infamous phrase from Donald Rumsfeld's speech. So do you think they want to have a Europe that's strong economically, politically, militarily, that can speak against them if there's a chance to? Thank you.
Historically, the answer is different administration by administration, you know. I tell you that I can testify that when we were building the euro, US could have stopped it in one moment. It should have been enough, some sort of soft speculation against one currency or the others, that we could be in disarray. And US has always helped, I repeat, because I was responsible for the lira that was very often under attack and so on. And without a constructive position of US, we should have never had that. And this has always been the general philosophy of the American administration, you know. In the last years, we had big point of dissents. So we have a diverging of this common way, you know. So it's clear that my answer is it depends upon the concrete political choice of the moment. I think strongly and clearly that the destiny of European Union and US is to cooperate. There is no other way out, you know. We are obliged to cooperate if you want to have a clear idea of the world, you know. And my only idea, my only fixed point is to cooperate with equal dignity. You know, but it's up to us. It's up to us to build our dignity. It's not that the American give us the right to have dignity if we have not.
I'm Carolina Harden. I'm a second year student at the University of Edinburgh. Professora Prodi, you spoke of investing in development of human resources. What do you propose should be done to block the brain drain, which is taking some of the brightest minds from Europe into the U.S., where there are better research institutes?
Yeah, this is my aim when I was talking about some sort of European Science Foundation, similar to that. You know, first step, put research and development as a priority. We engage ourselves in 3% of our income. We are so far away from it and decreasing and not increasing. This is the first truth. Without money, we cannot do anything. Second, we are a continent with the best intellectual abilities that are available in the world. 400,000 European researchers work in this moment in the United States. I repeat, 400,000. And if we want to get our goals, the goals I told you that are called the Lisbon goals, we need additional 700,000 research in Europe. This means that we must have laboratories and centers of research that will be at the top of the world, in which young people go there because they hope to become Nobel Prize in the future, you know, to give a simple idea of that, you know. And of course, this cannot be done, I repeat, at initial level, because otherwise there will be overlapping and complete inefficiency, and must have a free flow of researchers and scholars, otherwise we have no fermentation, and this is what we have to do. There is nothing else, you know. If we have going on our brain drain, and if we don't attract the best people in the world, we shall not do it. It's clear.
I'll interpret that as support for top-up fees. Thank you very much.
It's part of it. It's part of it. We need it, you know.
Last question here. You have the honor, so it better be good.
Hi. My name is Michele Petocchi. I study development studies here at LSC. Presidente, underlying the example of Mozambique, you repeated once again that the development of least developing countries has to be considered over a long-term perspective. However, do you have any language into which this crucial concern could be translated for the ordinary European citizen or elector whose purchasing power at the moment is sometimes reduced by half? So how can you make the people accept that what they do is important at global level?
You mean in terms of development? You know, I am uneasy because I do understand that this is the biggest sin that we make in front of humanity. You know, the resources that we deploy in this direction are not sufficient, you know. So I am uneasy to send a message of hope if we are contradictory with that, you know. With the problem that we have of AIDS or, you know, education, you know, in Africa at this moment, you know, with the terrible situation of wars that we have, I think that we should give the double of three times more resources in this direction, and also we should engage ourselves in being more present as collective Europe with no colonial past, with some trust that we have, you know, if we stick together and not as a nation, you know. But I tell you that in this moment, in this period of budget restrictions, it's not easy to elaborate a different policy in short term, you know. And I repeat, this is the thing that makes me more uneasy for the job I am doing. Thank you.
President, I think that applause gives me a very quick task of saying thank you, because I think the thanks of the audience are absolutely evident, particularly for your marathon of answering questions. But I do have one small thing to do, if you could just hold with me for 15 seconds. When you were photographed as taking over as Prime Minister of Italy in 1996, you were famously photographed wearing an LSE sweatshirt on your bicycle. And this attracted a lot of attention at the time.
I am sorry, but it's true.
And, well, it did occur to us that it may be that sweatshirt is getting a little bit old. And so in order to thank you, and also in order to boost the flagging economic situation of our students' union, we... we'd like to welcome you.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. I hope you come in. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, can I ask you to remain seated until the party leave the stage? Thank you very much.
Thanks, man.